Imagine for a second that you could just freeze time to save the person you love most in the entire world.
Right, like just hit pause on reality.
Exactly. You get a terrible terminal medical diagnosis and you just, go to sleep.
And then you wake up in some future where everything is miraculously fixed.
But, and here's the massive catch, to buy that ticket, you have to give up absolutely everything you own.
Your home, your savings, literally everything.
Yeah, your entire legacy. So, would you do it?
It's a heavy question.
It really is. And that impossible question is the beating heart of a sci-fi novella we're doing a deep dive into today called The Time We Buy by Donald Fire-Smith.
And we actually have the author's personal background notes for this one too.
Which is awesome. So our mission today isn't just to geek out over the sci-fi tech in the story.
Right, though the tech is fascinating.
It is, but we want to really explore the agonizing ethics of survival. We're going to examine the human cost of delaying the inevitable and figure out just how far people will go when mortality backs them into a corner.
Yeah, because reading those personal notes from the author, it gives us this rare window into how he built this world.
Completely.
What we're looking at is, well, it's essentially a laboratory for human desperation. We are forced to ask whether saving a life mathematically is worth the cost of what you destroy emotionally.
And it gets intensely personal right out of the gate. I mean, we're immediately introduced to this couple, Tom and Laura.
Right.
Tom is 68, and he's just been handed a truly devastating diagnosis, progressive, incurable Parkinson's disease.
Which is just awful.
Yeah. And Laura's 59. She actually works as a physician assistant, but she's battling her own rapidly worsening arthritis.
So they're both physically struggling.
Exactly. So they're
Yeah.
sitting at their kitchen table, just staring down this terrifying reality, doing the brutal math of their future. They're looking at specialized nursing homes that cost like $10,000 a month.
The terror they're facing here is really twofold. I mean, Tom is looking at the progressive loss of his motor
Right,
functions.
the rigid muscles, the tremors.
Yeah, and the loss of speech. But his mind remains completely intact, just trapped inside this failing vessel.
That is just a nightmare.
It is. But Laura's fear is entirely different, though just as profound, you know? Because of her medical background, she intimately understands the actual physical mechanics of caregiving.
Because she does it for a living.
Exactly. She knows exactly what lifting, turning, and bathing a grown adult is going to demand of her own failing joints. She's harboring this very quiet, very real dread.
Like, what happens when she physically breaks down while trying to keep her husband alive?
Precisely.
So that sheer desperation drives them to a really radical alternative. They find this company called CryoLife Solutions.
The medical hibernation company.
Right. And the company isn't pitching some, retro sci-fi freezing process. They are very explicit about calling it medical hibernation.
And the scientific distinction the author draws here is crucial for making the story feel plausible. The company rep actually walks them through why traditional cryogenic freezing, like just dumping a body in liquid nitrogen, is essentially a biological death sentence.
Because of the water in our bodies.
Yeah, human tissue is mostly water. When water freezes, it expands. It forms these jagged ice crystals.
Ooh, yikes.
Right. So on a cellular level, those crystals act like microscopic knives. They physically puncture and shred the cell walls from the inside out. It causes irreversible, catastrophic tissue damage.
I always think of that mistake where you accidentally push a bag of lettuce to the very back of the fridge.
Oh, that's a great example.
Yeah, it freezes. And when it thaws out, it hasn't been preserved at all. It just turns into this puddle of dark green mush
Yep.
because all the cellular structure just completely collapsed.
That is the exact biological trap CryoLife avoids. So instead of freezing, the process involves cooling the patients to just a few degrees above freezing while pumping them full of specialized chemical protectants.
So they aren't totally stocked.
No, they don't stop the human metabolism entirely. They just chemically and thermally suppress it to an absolute crawl. It really mirrors the biology of like an Arctic wood frog or a hibernating bear.
That's wild.
Yeah, the metabolic rate drops so low that a patient only physically ages about 1 month for every full year they spend under the ice.
Okay, let's unpack this. The science sounds highly regulated and honestly pretty plausible, but the cost of entry is absolute.
It's astronomical.
Yeah, to afford this, Tom and Laura have to liquidate their entire lives. I mean, they sign over their retirement funds, their Social Security,
Yeah.
the deed to their house. literally everything.
It is a massive gamble.
It's like putting all your life's casino chips on a single roulette spin that won't land for a decade. They're basically agreeing to wake up completely penniless, homeless, and displaced in time. But, you know, with the hope that a cure for Tom's Parkinson's will finally exist.
And they view it as a total financial sacrifice for a medical miracle. But what they are completely blind to in that moment is the emotional debt they are about to incur.
Oh, absolutely.
The immediate devastating cost of this isn't financial at all.
Right, it's familial. So they invite their 33-year-old daughter, Jessica, over for dinner to break the news.
And how does that go?
Not well. She does not react with quiet, noble understanding. She is absolutely furious. She doesn't see a medical miracle at all. She just feels entirely abandoned.
What's really fascinating here is the ideological clash between the generations. Jessica immediately points to the massive collateral damage of their choice.
Right, because of her daughter.
Exactly. She has a 2-year-old daughter named Emma. By choosing to go to sleep for 10 or 15 years, Tom and Laura are unilaterally deciding that this little girl will grow up without her grandparents.
Wait, I need to stop and push back on Tom and Laura here.
Go for it.
We've been painting the parents as these, like, tragic, romantic figures trying to survive against the odds. But from Jessica's point of view, this is a profound betrayal.
It really is.
If you put yourself in Jessica's shoes for a second, how could you ever accept your parents voluntarily checking out of your life for a medical long shot? They're effectively dying to her right then and there.
Yeah, she actually accuses her mom of being selfish.
She does. She claims Laura is just choosing to sleep because she doesn't want the physical burden of being a caregiver.
Mm-hmm.
And the wild part is, Laura admits that it's partially true.
And that moment of brutal honesty really strips away the romantic veneer of the hibernation.
Totally.
Laura acknowledges the dark truth that she does not want to spend the next decade watching the man she loves fade into a shell, especially while her own body breaks under the strain.
Which is human, but so harsh to hear.
Right. The parents are viewing this through the lens of buying time to fight death. But Jessica sees them trading a guaranteed concrete present for a purely theoretical future.
Wow, yeah.
It's basically a form of emotional cryogenics. They think they're just pausing their bodies, but they're actually pausing their relationships, expecting to thaw them out a decade later without any freezer burn.
Well, Jessica realizes she has no legal or physical power to stop them. So the dinner ends in disaster. Tom and Laura go to the facility, they lie down in their respective pods, they hold hands, and the chemical cocktail pulls them under.
Expecting utopia.
Exactly. They're expecting to wake up in this shiny, technologically advanced future with a cure just waiting for them.
But the reality they wake up to shatters that expectation instantly. They are pulled out of hibernation violently. I mean, they are choking, disoriented, convulsing.
Because it hasn't been 10 or 15 years.
No, it hasn't. It's only been 8 years and 10 months. It's October 2041.
And the facility is a wreck.
It's dark, it's freezing, and it's running entirely on failing backup generators. The fuel is almost completely gone.
The only senior medical staff left is a physician named Dr. Ramirez, and he has to deliver the unthinkable news. That advanced future they banked everything on. It doesn't exist. The world has effectively ended.
Which raises an incredibly important question. What exactly broke the world while they were sleeping? According to the author's narrative timeline, just 11 months after Tom and Laura went under, a highly contagious avian influenza strain crossed over into the human population. The text refers to it as the H9N8 China flu.
And it was bad.
Biologically devastating. As airborne and contagious as measles, with a massive fatality rate.
But, and this is key, the tragedy in the story isn't that humanity lacked the science to fight it. The British actually developed a vaccine in just 4 months that had a 99% efficacy against severe illness and death.
Yeah, the failure wasn't biological, it was sociological.
How so?
According to the narrative, that life-saving vaccine was widely rejected. There was a rampant spread of anti-vaxxer conspiracy theories, political disinformation, and just a completely fractured public trust in institutions.
So people just refused to take it.
Right. And because the virus was allowed to spread and replicate unchecked through hundreds of millions of unprotected hosts, it mutated 16 months later into a variant that bypassed all existing immunities.
Now, I need to pause here for a quick but really vital note for you, the listener. In the personal background notes provided alongside the novella, Donald Firesmith explicitly states that this specific apocalyptic premise was heavily inspired by his own progressive political views.
Yes, and his personal frustration with anti-science rhetoric during the second Trump administration.
Exactly. And we want to be absolutely crystal clear here. We are not taking sides, and we are not endorsing or validating these political viewpoints. We are just impartially reporting the narrative framework and the foundational ideas the author used to build his fictional apocalypse.
And understanding that authorial intent is really key to analyzing the text. He is constructing a world where humanity's downfall isn't an alien invasion or a meteor.
Right.
It's a self-inflicted wound born from a rejection of science. And the breakdown of society in the book isn't just people getting sick, it is a cascading failure of modern infrastructure.
But how does that actually happen mechanistically? We always hear about, the grid going down, but how does a virus turn the lights off?
It's a domino effect of labor and supply chains. When hospitals become overrun with the unvaccinated, panic sets in. The essential workers who maintain the power plants, who drive the fuel trucks, who manage the water treatment facilities, they stop going to work to protect their own
Oh,
families.
wow, that makes sense.
Right. Without fuel deliveries, backup generators at power plants die. When the power grid shuts down, refrigeration fails, meaning food spoils and medications degrade. Without power, water pumps stop pushing clean water into cities.
So it's not even just the virus anymore.
Exactly. Within weeks, people aren't just dying of the mutated virus. They are dying of secondary infections, dysentery from bad water, and starvation. The text states that between the virus and the cascading collapse, 4 to 5 billion people died worldwide.
That is unfathomable.
In the United States alone, the casualty rate was around 90%.
It's just the ultimate tragic irony. Tom and Laura sacrificed everything for the promise of advanced medical science, only to wake up in a world that burned itself down because it refused to take a shot. It's like hitting pause on a movie to go get popcorn, only to come back and find the TV and the house have burned down.
That's exactly what it's like. So, with the facility's generators dying, staying in the pods means freezing to death.
They have to leave.
Yeah, a group of 59 people, 47 groggy hibernators, and 12 remaining staff members, they're forced to march north in search of any remaining civilized settlement.
And on the way, they stop at this massive abandoned warehouse store, think of like a Costco or a Sam's Club, to scavenge for anything that can keep them alive.
Did they find anything?
They find some heavy winter clothes, which actually saves them from exposure, but the pharmacy section has been entirely stripped bare by looters years ago. So Tom checks his pockets. He only has a one-day supply of his Parkinson's medication left.
Oh no.
His tremors are returning. His muscles are stiffening by the hour, and he was walking into an apocalypse in a failing body.
The group eventually stumbles upon a fortified settlement called New Hope. It's run by this incredibly pragmatic leader named Mayor Julie Phillips. And it's here that the survivors are introduced to the absolute cold reality of post-apocalyptic triage.
The survival math.
Exactly. Mayor Phillips operates her settlement strictly on survival math. New Hope is constantly on the brink of starvation. One bad harvest or one harsh winter means they all die.
High stakes.
Very. Therefore, she has a strict policy. She will only take in able-bodied people who can physically contribute hard labor to the community's survival.
And this leads to a scene that is just incredibly difficult to process. Among the group of hibernators who march north, six of them are in wheelchairs.
Yeah.
Mayor Phillips looks at them, does the brutal survival math in her head, and turns them away. She gives them 1 week's worth of food rations and sends them back out the gates. It is a guaranteed death sentence.
The utilitarian logic is airtight, even if it's morally repugnant. If she feeds the sick, the healthy workers starve and everyone dies. By cutting the weak, the strong survive. Laura is granted entry immediately because her skills as a physician assistant are arguably the most valuable resource in the wasteland.
But Tom's situation is way more precarious.
Obviously.
Tom is physically deteriorating rapidly. His muscles are rigid, his speech is starting to slur. But he's allowed to stay on a strict trial basis because his mind is still sharp. He can sit in a chair and teach the settlement's children how to read and write.
So he still has a function.
Yeah, he gets a temporary reprieve from the survival math solely because he still has a measurable utility. Here's where it gets really interesting, though. Let's look at Mayor Phillips. At what point does logical survival math cross the line into losing the very humanity you are trying to save?
That's the million-dollar question.
Right. If you are sending sick people in wheelchairs out into the freezing woods to die so you can have enough calories to live, what exactly is the society you are preserving? How do you look in the mirror after making that call?
That paradox is the core philosophical takeaway of this section. By mathematically optimizing for human survival, you must actively destroy the empathy that makes humanity worth saving in the first place.
Yeah, and that's heavy.
And that exact guilt haunts Laura every single day at New Hope. She watches those wheelchairs roll away, knowing her medical skills bought her a VIP pass while others were condemned. The shame of being complicit in that survival math plants a psychological seed in her that completely alters her trajectory later.
Well, Tom manages to survive and teach at New Hope for almost 3 years. Despite his terrifying physical decline, he builds this really beautiful bond with a sweet little six-year-old girl named Maya. She brings him drawings and he teaches her how to spell.
That's a nice reprieve.
It is, but eventually the lack of medication and a severe bout of winter pneumonia catch up to him and he passes away peacefully.
And his death severs Laura's main tie to the settlement. Shortly after, she catches a rumor from a passing scavenger about a functional settlement to the southeast in a town called Riverside.
Wait, Riverside?
Yes. Riverside was where her daughter Jessica lived before the collapse. Driven by the desperate hope of finding her family, Laura leaves New Hope with two companions, a woman named Ingrid and a man named Jackson.
And the journey south is an absolute nightmare. It really highlights how quickly civilization vanishes. Mm-hmm. I mean, they're walking through old suburban neighborhoods, but nature has entirely reclaimed them, and they are being hunted.
By what?
Not by wolves, but by a terrifying pack of feral suburban dogs. We're talking German Shepherds, a Doberman, Huskies. Pets that used to sleep on couches have reverted to apex predators the second the dog food ran out.
It's a brilliant sociological metaphor by the author. The dogs represent how quickly domesticated systems, you know, pets, medicine, human morality, how quickly they revert to their primal, ruthless baseline when the power grid fails.
It's terrifying.
So the pack corners the trio at an abandoned, overgrown house. They manage to scramble inside, but Jackson's leg is severely mauled by the Doberman in the process.
And they are trapped inside. Worse, their makeshift cart containing all their drinking water is left out in the yard, completely surrounded by this snarling pack. Jackson evaluates his shredded leg. He knows he can't walk, and in this world without antibiotics, the bite is a death sentence anyway.
So he makes a choice.
He does the survival math. He offers to stay behind, bleed out, and barricade the door from the inside so Laura and Ingrid can slip out a back window and escape. He is offering them the exact same utilitarian logic Mayor Phillips used at New Hope.
Cut the dead weight to save the strong.
Exactly.
If we connect this to the bigger picture, this is the pivotal moment of character evolution for Laura. Jackson is presenting her with the logical mathematical choice, but Laura refuses it.
She just snaps.
She has carried the guilt of those wheelchairs at New Hope for 3 years. She violently rejects the survival math.
She absolutely loses her mind, but in the best way possible. She tells Jackson, "I am done leaving people behind because they can't walk."
Good for her.
Yeah. She duct tapes a heavy kitchen knife to her wrist, grabs an aluminum baseball bat, and she and Ingrid kick the front door open. They go back out onto that porch, physically fighting back a pack of starving apex predators just long enough to drag their water cart inside.
It is a profound reclamation of her moral agency. Laura is outright refusing to let the cold mathematical logic of the apocalypse dictate her humanity anymore.
She's taking the control back.
Exactly. She won't let infection, statistics, or teeth make her choices for her. She decides that if they are going to survive, they're going to do it as human beings who protect the weak, not as feral animals who abandon them.
And because of that moral victory, they manage to outlast the dogs. Jackson recovers just enough to limp, and they finally reach the gates of the Riverside settlement.
Which brings us to the most emotionally devastating moment of this entire deep dive.
Yeah, brace yourselves.
Laura walks into the bustling Riverside settlement, scanning the faces of the survivors, and she actually finds Jessica. Her daughter is alive.
But if you were expecting some tearful, joyous Hollywood reunion, prepare to be crushed. It is incredibly tragic. Jessica survived, yes. But her husband, David, and that sweet little two-year-old girl, Emma, they are both dead.
And the cruelest part is that Jessica's family did everything right. They took the British vaccine, but they died anyway, victims of the secondary societal collapse.
So the vaccine didn't even save them?
No, because when the medical infrastructure evaporated due to the unvaccinated masses, simple secondary infections became lethal.
The details Jessica shares with her mother are just agonizing. She tells Laura that as little Emma was dying of a fever, she kept asking if her grandma and grandpa were coming to wake up and save her.
Oh, that is heartbreaking.
Jessica had to dig graves and bury her own child and her husband in the dirt completely alone.
And then Jessica makes a confession to her mother that is incredibly hard to hear. She admits that the only thing that kept her alive through the starvation and the grief, the only reason she didn't just walk out into the frozen woods and let the end take her, was spite.
Just pure anger.
Yes. She survived on the burning, furious hatred she held against her parents. She stayed alive purely to one day look her mother in the eye and make her answer for choosing to sleep in a pod while her family died.
They just collapse into each other in this incredibly complex, messy web of grief, furious anger, and desperate relief.
Yeah.
Laura steps up to become Riverside's medical provider, basically trying to atone for her absence.
Trying to make up for lost time.
Yeah. And sometime later, Jessica finally asks her mother the ultimate impossible question. Was it worth it? Was giving up everything and going into hibernation worth the cost?
Laura's response perfectly encapsulates the tragedy and the beauty of their choice. She reaches into her pocket and pulls out Tom's antique pocket watch, which is still ticking.
Wow.
She tells Jessica that, yes, the world burned, and yes, they lost almost everything, but the hibernation bought nearly 3 years of extra life for Tom at New Hope.
3 extra years.
3 years where his mind was clear, where he wasn't a burden, but a revered teacher. 3 years where a little girl named Maya loved him and brought him drawings. To Laura, buying those 3 years for the man she loved was worth any price.
So what does this all mean? I really have to push back heavily on this concept of worth, because the irony of that transaction is a tough pill to swallow.
It definitely is.
Laura and Tom paid everything they had to get 3 extra years together. In a vacuum, they got exactly what they paid for. But the hidden, terrible cost of that transaction was transferred directly to their daughter.
Right, they didn't pay the full price themselves.
No. Their absence meant Jessica had to bury her child alone. It is a zero-sum game of grief. The time Tom gained was paid for by the trauma Jessica endured.
It perfectly distills the core takeaway from these source materials. Strip away the sci-fi cryogenics, the mutated virus, and the post-apocalyptic survival math. At its foundation, this is a study of the desperate, sometimes incredibly selfish, and sometimes deeply beautiful things human beings will do just to buy a fraction more time with the people they love. It's all about time.
Yes. But it reveals a fundamental truth. Time is the one currency in the universe we cannot put in a bank. We can't freeze it, and we can't save it. We can only spend it.
That is so well said. It really makes you evaluate your own daily choices. The story frames this entire concept of buying time through the extreme lens of radical science and million-dollar hibernation tanks.
But that's not really what worked.
Exactly. If you look closely at Tom's final years at the settlement, he didn't actually achieve immortality through the cryogenic fluid. The technology utterly failed him.
It just delayed things.
Right. He achieved a form of immortality through that little girl, Maya. Long after Tom is gone, Maya's going to grow up, maybe have kids of her own, and she will remember the kind man with the shaking hands who sat in the cold and helped her spell the word tractor.
The advanced technology they bet their lives on crumbled to dust, but the simple, everyday human connection endured. Exactly. So we'll leave you with this final thought to mull over today. If you suddenly knew, without a shadow of a doubt, that your own pocket watch was going to permanently stop tomorrow, would you exhaust yourself trying to build a machine to freeze time? Or would you turn around, look at the people right in front of you, and spend every last second of it today?